Rachel, thanks so much for joining me today. Your new recording pairs Sir Edward Elgar's concerto with the first concerto by Max Bruch. Other than the fact that they're both romantic concertos, in your mind, what is the connection between the two?
They've always been paired in my thoughts due to a sort of unintentional pairing where the CD reissue of the historic interpretations by Yehudi Menuhin from the beginning of his career, which were made in separate years on 78s or whatever, but they were paired on CD for the reissue. So that kind of stuck in my mind. And then actually among the major romantic concertos in the standard repertory, the Bruch is the shortest and the Elgar is the longest, so that's another connection. But really it's the approach to sound for both of them. There's something so warm and personal and rich and lush that you try to get from the tone of your violin that made it feel like they belonged together, even if they were from decades apart and from different countries.
Your relationship with Sir Neville Mariner was a special one, and he was to conduct this recording with you before, unfortunately, he passed away. You had done quite a bit of preparation with him as his teacher was connected with Elgar. Can you tell us about that and what adjustments you had to make when Andrew Litton stepped in at the last minute?
Sir Neville, of course, was a violinist, and he had studied the Elgar with his teacher, Billy Reed, the great London concertmaster, who was the violinist that Elgar consulted with extensively as he was creating the concerto. So it was amazing to, you know, go through the score with Sir Neville and hear some of these stories that he had heard from his teachers working with Elgar. And sadly, Sir Neville passed away between the rehearsal and the recording session, so I'm so grateful for, you know, Andrew Litton, you know, just for stepping in and doing such a wonderful job. And it didn't cause me to, you know, change my interpretation per se, but he, you know, he brought his own sensibility to the project. And there's actually one wonderful tutti moment, meaning, you know, where the orchestra plays alone without me for a short bit of the piece, in the first movement of the Bruch concerto, where just rather than doing kind of a normal, you know, way of playing it, Andrew Litton had some very special, a very special approach that he brought to it, some very distinct ideas. So I really appreciated that he was taking so much care when, you know, conductors who are accompanying concertos often will, you know, do a good job, but not bring anything personal to the table. So I thought that was really awesome. And I'll never know what Sir Neville might have done in that tutti because we never got to do it, but I'm sure it would have been fantastic as well.
Now, your producer, Andrew Keener, has a great knowledge and passion for Elgar's music. What role did he play in making this recording unique?
You know, he'd recorded it with other violinists over the years, and he's a big Elgar aficionado, so he was just kind of, he was our watchdog, not only for the usual stuff that producers are, you know, there for, which is, you know, making sure that the ensemble is all lining up, that the musical expression is happening, that the intonation is good, but you know, he was also just making sure that it felt like Elgar, which he said it did, so that meant we got it right.
When people think of Elgar, I think the Enigma variations probably immediately come to mind. Do you find there to be similarities in the concerto to his other major works, or maybe some striking differences?
Well, actually, this is really one of his most personal pieces. He's really wearing his heart on his sleeve to an enormous degree. We're all more familiar with the cello concerto, not because it's a better work, but just because it's shorter, it's easier to program, and it's more immediately accessible. But this piece is so complex and really has such great rewards if you delve deep. And it was actually among Elgar's favorites of his own compositions, which is really interesting to note. He has a mysterious dedication at the beginning of the piece, which says, "Herein is enshrined the soul of dot, dot, dot." So, you know, there's something just very, very personal, very intimate about this music. Even when it's very extroverted, it's still, you know, coming from a very emotional place of him as a human.
I understand there's a lot of detail that Elgar put in the score for the soloist.
Actually, to just an unbelievable degree, much more so than most other concertos, in terms of just the articulations specified for each note, the gradations of dynamics, and the continual tempo fluctuations. There's really no swath of the music that you just play. He's always telling you, slow down a little, speed up a little. You know, so it's really to just make sure you're doing all of his instructions is already an enormous task. And then to live with the piece long enough that that all becomes internalized to the point where it comes out feeling natural is really a process and a journey.
Now, you might have some strong feelings about the music. So what if you disagree with the composer's markings?
Well, you know, some people might feel like, oh, gosh, you know, the composer is dead. I better not touch anything. And some people might feel like the composer is dead. I can do whatever I want. But actually, having had the great privilege of working with a number of living composers, in fact, the last 2 weeks, I gave the world premieres of two different violin concertos, of recent time. Well, the one was written for me for the Vancouver Symphony, and the other was written a couple years ago, and it was its first performance. Yeah, so having collaborated with living composers and understanding, you know, how the back and forth goes, I feel like that gives me some insights into where I have to, you know, be respectful of what the composer clearly wanted and where I have some, can take some liberty or have some freedom to deviate from that a little if I feel strongly. And, you know, so you just do the best you can, because ultimately in any musical performance, you have to try to bring the composer's music to life the best you can. But at the same time, the only way to do that is to have it be true to yourself. So, you know, it's a real collaboration somehow between performer and composer, even if the composer is dead.
The Brook was the first major concerto you studied, so you've played it many times over the course of your career. As with most works, the more times you play it, the more you seem to discover. What makes this work new and fresh for you every time you perform it?
Well, first of all, the melodies are just so incredibly gorgeous. You can never get tired of them. I've been playing it since I was 8 years old, and, you know, it's just still something I love returning to every time. There's a lot of room for rubato, unlike Elgar, where he told you, take a little time here, slow down this note, speed up that note. Brooke, in his opening cadenzas, for example, in the first movement, you know, writes these little moments where if you play it with the rhythms as notated on the page, it would be incredibly square and boring. I don't think any violinist has ever done that. It would be ridiculous. But you get to choose for yourself, actually, what dynamics you want to use, what scheme of ebb and flow do you want to use. And so you have a lot of room for personal choice, which is really quite fun. And you can play it a different way every night if you want to.
You've said the Brook is a wonderful introduction to people who are discovering classical music. Why do you feel that way?
Well, in demonstrations, I love to use that opening cadenza to explain what makes classical music so poetic. You know, there's so many non-classical styles, whether it's rock music, pop music, folk music. You know, you can pretty much have a steady backbeat, you know, to which you can tap your toe or snap your fingers or bang your head, depending on the genre. But, you know, you could turn a metronome on and the piece is going to be metronomic. And maybe there's a big tempo shift at one point, but it's still metronomic, right? Now, you take classical music and very often the beat is completely done away with, or there will be a section that has a steady pulse, but then it stretches a little. So this is one of the ways in which we're able to express every shade of feeling of the human experience through not being locked into that metronomic pulse. And it's Baroque music, you improvise, you add your own notes and ornaments and flourishes and things, but you know, from the classical period onwards, you're not really supposed to make up extra notes. You wouldn't take a melody of Brahms and add melismas like an R&B singer. I mean, that would be completely ridiculous. But yet, we still do a certain amount of extemporizing in the way that we shape the phrases. And the opening of the Brook Concerto is just a really illustrative way to show how we get to do our own type of improvising, so to speak. But also, you know, just the music of the piece, you know, first of all, it's a wonderful emotional journey. The first movement has angry parts, whereas the last movement has moments of triumph, and so it's, you know, sort of carries you through. But the second movement I love to use on occasional rock classical programs that I do, because it really is epic. It sounds like this, you know, sort of heroic love story or something, and it's just, you know, larger than life in a way, even though it has great moments of intimacy as well.
Violinist Rachel Barton Pine discussing her latest album here on the Community Idea Stations.